Welcome to the Reimagine Podcast, a podcast that seeks to reimagine faith and life in the community as we link, learn, and live together. I'm Greg English, along with Brad Hoffman and Brian Dupuy. Today, on episode 150, we take a look at well-intended dragons. Welcome to the podcast, everybody.
Hello.
Hello, hello.
150.
150.
I know. That's right. Was thinking about that.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
That is pretty amazing.
What we used to say as I lived in the Arab world was mabrok.
Uh-huh.
Not that we're broke, but mabrok is the Arabic word for congratulations.
In
French, félicitations.
Very nice.
What other language you want? I got it.
Sure. You're like a walking babble.
I hate to reveal this. Everything but Greek and Hebrew. I got it.
Yeah, that's right.
Hey. You're all good, man. All good.
So 150.
Here we go. 150.
Yeah.
So, you know,
we're on our way.
Yeah.
Yep.
Brian.
Yes.
I'm going to ask you. I'm baffled.
Yes.
But I'm sure you got a story.
Sure.
I approached you early in the week and said, you live not too far down on the farm, close to the church.
Very close.
Yes.
But you have two of your vehicles in the driveway here, parked beside each other. Pulled them in at a very fast speed because both sets of front wheels were hard left in the parking spot.
It was a harsh turn.
It was.
Yeah. In anger. Probably in anger.
Yes.
Yeah.
And two vehicles. And I looked over there and one was had a slightly back limp.
Yes.
And I noticed the donut tire.
The donut tire, yeah.
Give me the story.
Well, so we were in Bridgewater this past weekend on Saturday watching our cousin play ball, his last game, senior year type thing, you know, so they did a big thing. So we were there to see it. We stayed way too late, and so we had to make the, 2-hour drive back home.
Bridgewater is across the Blue Ridge Mountains.
Across the mountains. Yeah. Yep. So we were crossing Afton Mountain, got over top of it. It's beautiful at 10 o'clock at night. And then we, on our way down the mountain, my son, who sits in the far back, swears he heard something hit our car. I'm not sure what that could be, but
It's late.
Yeah. And the next thing we know, I hear what sounds like a truck, like a semi using an air brake coming up behind us. I look around and there's no one else around us. It's just us. And Evan said, I think that's our car. And sure enough, it was our back tire. Back tire blown, completely blown. And so thankfully, we were down the mountain at that point, and actually there's a rest area right there.
Not the dirt road that trucks take when they can't stop.
Filled with sand. Yeah. We didn't have to use the old emergency runoff. So we hobble in there and spend time changing the tire.
Was that like a Christmas story thing for you and Evan? You know, the old scene where the nuts go everywhere.
Yeah. Maybe in my mind. I was not happy about that.
No.
Oh, because it's freezing cold. And there we are changing the tire. We got the spare on. We're limping home, 50 miles an hour down 64. By 11:30 or so, close to midnight, we pull into the house and
You have really good luck with tires, man. I was just thinking about that.
Yeah.
I think Penny had a flat tire like out in front of our house a couple years ago back.
Yeah.
And we were out there changing the tire on it. I don't know why it was flat. It just was flat. So I didn't know what.
I think she took aim at a curb, if I remember right.
You need to rephrase that. Yeah. The curb was in the street.
Yeah. It did her wrong, and she was looking for payback and popped that thing.
That's great. Well, I tell you, it's interesting you talk about it because I was thinking about my oldest, Katie, had a Honda Accord, like a 2-door sport model, and she was somewhere in, I want to say in Lynchburg, maybe. I can't remember the actual place that she was at, but I remember getting the phone call that both front tires had blown simultaneously.
Oh, wow.
And so she must have hit something that both tires blew, which incorporated the airbags going off on the car, because I guess when they blew, they hit. Both front airbag or her airbag exploded in front of her too. So that was and it's one thing to change a tire; it's another thing to put in a new airbag.
Yeah.
So it's another.
Don't you love those stories? Brendan called me last week.
He too had a problem on the other side of Afton Mountain. Mm, mm-hmm. He referees high school basketball, so he has to travel the state some.
Yeah.
And he called me. He's at the gas station. I'm driving down 95 here going home, and he's screaming in my ear, "The gas tank won't open." I'm thinking, well, is the top stuck on it or whatever? He goes, no, the door won't open. I can't get the fuel door open. I got to be there, and I'm on the lights on. I have no gas. I got to be there. It's 45 minutes away. And I'm like, okay, let's see. Who's refereeing with you? Can you call the guy and tell him pick you up, number one?
Yeah.
But then I had to go home, and of course, you know, I'm the mechanic.
For sure, yeah.
Air quotes.
Yeah.
I had to get on YouTube and find out that the little plastic switch on the fuel door was snapped and wrong, so I had to show him, hey, go watch this YouTube, get up on the backside of your car, unhook it. I'm going up there this weekend just to check this whole vehicle situation out.
Oh, wow.
So I guess he's riding around with his fuel tank door open. Yeah. Like Brad. Brad didn't have a fuel tank.
Well, I have a – it is on there. It's just the cover's not. It's all secure.
And then you have 100 people driving by like, your door's open.
Yeah. It's all good.
I say they just put them back. Remember they used to be like behind the license plate?
Oh, flip it down, stick it in.
Flip it down. Yeah. Come on.
Yes.
Let's go back.
Let's go back.
That's right.
Well,
it's good stuff.
Let's
talk about something really important.
Yeah. Good stuff.
This is going to be a good conversation today because whether I should say this or not, when you read that book, just all kinds of different stories of the past come to fruition, right? Yeah. And I will tell you, it's a book that, why did they not issue this learning to me when I was actually in theological education?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Uh-huh.
I mean, we learned all 66 books and everything else, but
the
practicality of relationships, people, leadership, this should have been there.
Anyhow,
we're going to welcome Dr. Marshall Shelley to the podcast today. He's recently retired from Denver Seminary, where he served as the director of Doctor of Ministry Program and the associate professor of pastoral leadership and ministry. He was also the editor of Leadership Journal for 34 years, and as a vice president of at Christianity Today, where he oversaw a variety of publications and reports as there as well. He has a BA in journalism from Bethel University, and his MDiv is from Denver Seminary. His books include Well-Intended Dragons and Leadership Secrets of Billy Graham. So today we welcome Marshall to the podcast. How you doing?
Hey, good to be with you guys.
Great to have you.
Your stories of flat tires brings all sorts of memories back to mind, but we'll leave those for now.
That's right. Yeah. Be for our Patreon subscribers.
Yeah. We'll start collecting stories of flat tires.
Yeah.
But definitely a lot of them.
For sure. Yeah.
Well, I just want to say thanks for being here. Thanks for your work and what you do. But I'm really excited about the conversation as we dig in to the idea of well-intended dragons and what that is and how we grow and learn in that. But if you could just give us a few moments to share your story with our listeners.
Sure. I was raised in Denver, Colorado. You mentioned that I just recently retired from Denver Seminary. People ask me, Marshall, how long have you been at Denver Seminary? And I say, well, there's two answers to that question. I joined the faculty in 2016, but I first arrived in 1957 when I was three because my dad joined the faculty then. So, it's in some ways been a lifetime of being next to theological education, which with all the blessings and curses that involves. But it's been a good thing. I was raised in Denver, graduated high school, went to Bethel College in St. Paul, Minnesota. And then got a job in Chicago in publishing. And with the exception of getting my seminary degree from Denver Seminary during that time, the rest of my career was in the Chicago area. And then 2016, life came full circle and Denver Seminary invited me back as a faculty member. So that's a bit of the life story and less than a minute.
So if I read correctly, you're an outdoors person, so I'm sure you're thrilled to be back in Denver.
Oh, I call, I'm looking out my window right now at the Rocky Mountains, and I could not do that in Chicago. Chicago is what I call topographically challenged. It's very, very flat. Mm-hmm. And so hearing stories of you guys talking about coming down the Blue Ridge, I'm thinking, oh man, that's, you're talking my language. So topography is a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking the Blue Ridge compared to the Rockies, that's topographically challenged.
That's true.
But we still love them here.
That's right.
They're the real deal. So, yeah.
It's all we got.
So let's talk about Well-Intended Dragons. Kind of like, what was the reason for writing that book, and what in the world is a well-intended dragon?
Good question. I was hired as an assistant editor at Leadership Journal, which was a journal for pastors. And this was back a number of years ago, but we were recognizing that we really wanted to deal with some of the realities of ministry that had not been overreported. You know, what are some of the things that virtually every pastor deals with that we haven't told stories about before? And one of my bosses had been a longtime executive pastor at a large church. And he said, you know, I think one thing I've never really read about is the unique dynamic of difficult people in churches. You know, they mean well, they are sincere, they love God, but they just destroy relationships. They just leave in their wake, you know, bitterness, suspicion. You know, they enter the room and tensions rise. You know, you just start getting the acid reflux in your stomach because this person's in the room. What's going on there? And, you know, one of my other coworkers who's into science fiction and has a very sort of poetic bent, he says, yeah, they're just well-intentioned dragons. And wow. Suddenly just silence in the room. Well-intentioned dragons. That's it. They're sincere. They mean well. Their intentions are good, but the fruit of their lives is tension, suspicion, destroys the unity and the spirit, the healthy spirit of a congregation. And so he said, "That's it. We've got to do a book on this phenomenon." Marshall, you're up. So I said, wow, what do I do there? He said, well, I think we'll do some research. You know, we can do some, some actual qualitative research. But I think this just means you hit the road. You start making appointments with pastors and, you know, describing the reality we've just discussed here and say, does this ring true? Do you know anybody like that? And would you tell me the stories off the record? We won't name names, but if you could tell some of these stories. And so I took that on as one of my challenges there at Leadership Journal. And we did do a survey of our readers, and turns out that when we just asked, have you or are you now dealing with difficult people in your congregation, we described this, and 82% said yes. Exclamation point! I must admit, I didn't meet too many of those 18% that said no. It seems like it's a fairly common experience for there to be individuals in the church that may be believers. You know, that mm-hmm. these are not people who wake up in the morning saying, what evil can I accomplish today? Mm-hmm. These are people who consider themselves servants of God, but just the way they go about it is relationally damaging. We recognize that there's IQ, which is, intelligence, mm-hmm. but there's also, EQ, which is emotional intelligence. And some people are, may be able to cite all sorts of Bible verses, but they're, relational intelligence is lacking, and mm-hmm. so this is one of the realities that we wrote this book about, and that was a long time ago. We've had to do a second edition since and add some things, but that's the reality. That's the concept that that originated this conversation.
If there's ever a book that you want to write that you know is going to be around for generations. It's a book on problem people in the church, right? I mean, that's like, yeah, it's yeah. And now, especially as you mentioned, there's a lot more talk on emotionally healthy people, emotionally healthy disciples, and So yeah, it's just as
it's almost like the category of there's a number one bestseller and there's a always still selling.
Yeah, 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 for sure.
But you know, Marshall, it's interesting because I think back on years as a pastor, and I can think of two particular people in the history of my ministry that I would classify as kind of these very difficult people. And what's interesting is they were well-intentioned. I mean, they really were. I mean, I think they were well-meaning. You know, they had a goal and their goal was to do good. It was just the path that was taken and the conflict that arose that created kind of the organizational discomfort or the relational discomfort that, as you said, creates suspicion and other things like that. And I think that's interesting when you look back on that, that at least in my own personal experience, very well-meaning yet extremely difficult. And then, you know, how you go about that. Now, in the book, you describe several different types. I think there's like 10 or 12 of them, if I remember correctly, like bird dog and wet blanket and busybody and merchant amok. We probably ought to talk about merchant amok.
That's the title of the episode.
But what are out of those, and as you think back when you wrote the book and you've done the revision, have you added some to that list? Have you redefined that list? And what are some prevalent ones out there today?
Well, I don't have a snappy label for some of the more recent ones, but after the book had been out about 10 or 15 years, the publisher came back and said, I think things have developed to the point that we need a second edition. And in the publishing business, a second edition means that you need at least 20% new content,
right?
20% new material. And so he said, is there an additional, two or three chapters that need to be added or changed in this? And by that time, almost immediately, I said yes. Number one, when the book was written, it was before the internet, if you can believe that. I'm old enough to have written a book before the internet. But the electronic warriors, anonymous blogs, forwarding emails with everybody's name attached, reply to all with my hot response to something that's gotten me upset. So, electronic warfare, was added, and just people, again, for they may be well intended, but they just don't realize that you just don't send private emails to an entire mailing list with your commentary on the email. Mm-hmm. That's just time out. That's against the rules. That's just not relationally, wise in any way, shape or form. Okay. So just the electronic dynamics of dealing with disagreements and relational issues. A second thing is the awareness that we have all developed more recently of mental illness and medications, mood altering medications, and what that does to relationships. When people are taking, I'm diabetic. I'm on insulin, and when my insulin gets low, my moods, my responses to things are not the most sanctified. And so the effects of medications and anti-anxiety meds, anti-depression meds, some of these kinds of things are also realities that we are increasingly aware of and affect the relationships and the way we interact with each other. Mm-hmm.
So I think the answer to this question is yes, but as leaders, are we too quick just to dismiss those because we look at their action rather than their well intentions?
Well, I do think the church has come a long way just in the last, 8 or 10 years on this, on understanding that there is always a story behind someone's words and actions. Mm-hmm. The initial temptation is to take what someone says or what someone does as a spiritual issue. Well, if only they get right with the Lord, they wouldn't say these things, or they wouldn't do these things. You know, everything, it's a temptation for those of us who are in ministry, who've been to seminary, who study the Bible, as seeing everything as a sin issue. You know, when you see yourself as a hammer, the whole world is a nail. And so I have one response to any situation I've got, and that's to, you know, pound a nail. Well, sometimes there's more to the, you know, not everything is a nail. And so, you know, we saw this at Leadership Journal when we were doing some research on attitudes toward mental illness. You know, is early on, you know, say 20 years ago, we asked the question, is mental illness something that can be dealt with prayer? You know, prayer and Bible reading is the response to mental illness. Well, a much higher percentage said, well, yes, of course. You know, there's no such thing as depression. You know, there's no such thing as paranoia or schizophrenia. There's no such thing as multiple personality disorder. If you just pray enough, those things will be, you know, that's the hammer. We deal with everything with prayer and confession. And that's an important part, but there are, we've recognized more recently that some of these things have dynamics that maybe do need medication. There may be a chemical imbalance there. So that's just on the one, we can spend a whole conversation on just, you know, the mental illness dynamics that we're now increasingly aware of today. But, you know, there's a lot of things that that complicate that. But the point I'm trying to make, I guess, is we recognize that there's always more going on than what appears on the surface. There's a reason people are acting the way they do, and sometimes it takes some time just to uncover what's actually driving some of these problematic behaviors.
Yeah, because the issue may not be the issue. Exactly. You know what I mean? I mean, there's something, as you talk about, there's something more.
Typically, it's not, right?
Yeah. And so how do you do that? So one of the things that you deal with or talk about are strategies for dealing and coping with difficult people in the book. Can we talk about a few of those specifically and I guess developing a competency here and how we as leaders can minister well in this situation or any situation, a difficult person?
Well, I'd say, you know, job number one is to have a healthy inner circle. That means have either on the staff or with the elders or deacons or whatever your church government is, having a healthy leadership structure is job one. Being able to develop a group that can help you define what normal is and what's abnormal with some of these relationships. Is everybody else crazy or am I the crazy one? Yeah.
I love that question.
Being able to, and this, you know, this may take some time, but, you know, being able to develop some relationships where you can be honest with one another, where you can bring situations that may be ambiguous or confusing or mysterious and just say, I'm trying to sort this out. Can you help me think this through, see this through? What am I missing here? And, you know, a leadership team that can do that is really an essential, component of being able to have a healthy environment in which to handle some of these well-intentioned dragons.
No, that's good. And I think it's different, like for us, because we have a multiple staff scenario here that we have circles on our team that relate and interact. I think sometimes of the guys or the individuals that are the solo, where they're in a smaller church setting where they're the only ones. And isolation does play a huge part in this. And when you deal with difficult people. You need a circle of people, maybe not in the church, but even outside the church, of peers that can help you process, that you can pick up the phone and call. I think one of the most challenging things in ministry is looking at your phone and not knowing who to call or who to text, you know, right, or not having somebody. So that's a huge thing, as you're talking about, just to bounce off if I'm not crazy or not in this.
Right. Yeah. Just, can somebody give me a reality check here?
Yeah.
You know, Max Dupree, who wrote a book called Leadership as an Art, famously said, the first task of a leader is to define reality. And sometimes defining reality takes more than one person. It can be hard just to sit in my chair and define what the reality is. It's, you know, am I misreading a situation? What is the, you know, what's really happening here? It does take more than one person to be able to see that, to be able to interpret that, and be able to respond accordingly. But that's where a helpful leadership team, and if I may be, you know, so bold and selfish, that's one of the benefits of a doctorate of ministry program. You mentioned a lot of people feeling isolated in ministry situations. Being able to go through a couple of years of study with a cohort that has also been through some of the challenges of ministry and can be a reality check, be a source of, you know, additional seeing, hearing, interpreting for you. That's pretty essential.
No, that's good. That makes that's a huge difference, for sure. So it almost is, there's a component to self-care here for the leader. That's can you think of any, or would you suggest any maybe practical measures of self-care, just even beyond a group of people, but for leaders and ministers that are dealing with they're going to, if they haven't dealt with somebody difficult, they're going to. So at some point in time. So it is being prepared for that even. But anything that you would suggest for us, and it's just a measure of self-care.
Besides kickboxing. That's a given. That's a given. We'll take that one.
That's a little proactive.
MMA or WWE.
That's right. That's right.
Well, in the next, in an hour and a half, I'm going to be playing pickleball. So
that's huge here, man. Huge everywhere. Yes.
Yeah, I just got introduced to that. But it's, you know, for somebody my age who just recently retired, you know, it's ping pong on a tennis court.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's perfect. It's perfect.
So are you competitive?
I must confess that, yes, those urges are definitely there.
I am a recreational sport theologian, and I would defend that competition is biblical. So if you need to call me, I'm available.
That's right. That's right.
I don't even know what you asked. What'd you ask?
I asked about self-care.
Well, there you go.
He's playing pickleball. Pickleball and kickboxing.
No, that's, you're absolutely right. And, Denver Seminary, one of the growing programs here is spiritual formation. Mm. And basically it's, part of that is recognizing that when Peter in 2 Peter 3:17 and 18 says, grow in grace and the knowledge of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, that implies that your spiritual transformation was not complete the hour you first believed. I was raised in a Baptist home, and I was taught and I was convinced that I received everything I needed for salvation the moment I prayed the prayer, the sinner's prayer. It took me a while to realize, no, the job's not done the moment you first believed. There is a process of growing in grace and knowledge of our Lord and Savior Jesus. That requires some attention. That's just not an automatic. That's just not a plug and play. Like physical health, like mental health, growing intellectually, some training intentional effort is required to mature, to be fruitful, to continue to be able to be faithful and effective in life.
You are speaking our language, and we're going to invite you back for another episode just on that topic. Seriously, that's our language, but absolutely. Sorry, didn't mean to interrupt you, Bob.
That's it. But I just look at, you know, how you grow in grace. You know, you have to be able to receive grace, you know, recognizing that God says, my grace is sufficient for you. But man, I don't think I had any clue what it meant that grace is sufficient the hour I first believed.
Right.
It's a growing thing, being able to receive grace, being able to extend grace in different situations. That's, oh my goodness, I've got so much to learn on what that, you know, what that means. But, but yeah, so I would say, you know, your question about self-care is, you know, walking with people who can have some of these conversations, say, how are you doing in receiving grace? How are you doing in extending it? Talking through some of the situations where those are not automatic responses that require some intentionality, some persistence, some perseverance, some, you know, continuing to, you know, walk faithfully in those situations.
So I'm thinking of some things that, as you're talking about, if I could tell myself some things 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. Don't let the dragon steal all your time. This is what I'm thinking right now before I ask the question. Don't let the dragon steal all your time. Trust that the Father genuinely loves you as a son or as a daughter, not just a leader, you know, but he loves me as a child. See reality, right? Not know that somebody else's firestorm is true reality. You got to see more of the situations taking place. Those things are popping in my mind. I wish I knew then. What would you say? Like, I still have to coach myself under certain those things. I have to continue to remind myself to coach myself through those things, that slow it down, trust the Father, see reality, look at the whole picture, you know, and apply those things. What would you say to a leader today that is struggling facing some of these dragons?
In the book, I actually conclude with the story of Pacomius. Pacomius was a you know, I'm an army dad. I have a, you know, a son-in-law who's in the army, so I have a particular, you know, affection for people in the military. And Pacomius was an Egyptian soldier back in the third century, the 200s, and came to Christ through the kindness of Christians in Thebes in Egypt. And when he got out of the military, he was serious about his faith, and he'd been some of his mentors had taught him that if you're really serious about your faith, you need to become a hermit and live the holy life out in the desert by yourself. Is sort of their survival tactics, I guess. But he went out there, but he recognized something's missing here. Being a Christian all by yourself, something's lacking. And what he discovered with this, what was lacking was what you just talked about, Greg, is I need people who test my patience. How can I learn patience if nobody's testing me? how can I be kind if nobody is tempting me to be hostile? How can I love if I'm by myself? Love, by definition, requires somebody else. Pacomius pulled some of these hermits, and hermits are not easy to live with. They're very eccentrics, and when you put eccentrics together, that's weird, but he says that, you know, in order to essentially grow in grace, we need to be around people who test ours. And you know, the difficulties are part of God's way of maturing us. And so, Greg, I guess I would say that's, you know, one of my first responses is that seeing difficult people not as as unfortunate additions to my life, but in some strange way as being God's gift to you for this season, being able to learn something that you wouldn't learn any other way is part of, you know, the faithful step here. It's like, okay, God, this person's in my life and is causing me some lost sleep. But whatever you want to teach me from that, teach me, Lord, help me learn it, because I don't want to have to repeat this course.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. That's grace. God's self-giving in that situation. I mean, that's good. That's good. That's not easy.
No, it's not.
But it goes back to
the Christian life.
But it goes back to the journey.
Everybody said it was.
That was when you prayed the sinner's prayer. Yeah, that's not even easy. Right. No, I just kidding. but anyway, I'm sorry. I'm getting off course here. But anyhow,
that's good. Yeah.
Oh, no, I get in trouble. So just an interesting question, just as somebody that's written as an author, and I always find this, after you've written something down the road, I wrote something that was published back in 2007, and I've often thought, hey, what will we add differently? We talked about doing revision, we're not doing one, but if you were to add more chapters, if you were to do a third revision, is there a chapter you would add to the book?
That's a good question. I've not thought about that. I don't know. I do. Well, just given the stage of life I'm in right now, I would say that different challenges in this different seasons of life are interesting to me.
Yeah.
I remember in my 40s was really the first time that I recognized I'm not the same person I was before. How I'm reacting to things. How I'm, I was a dad with kids, and I had them. I still have now, issues with anger at times. Things will happen that just don't turn out the way that I thought they would, and anger comes up. And I thought, wow, where's that coming from? Why am I reacting that way? This is not what I want to do or what I want to be. There at times, I became the dragon, I remember listening to a tape by a guy who's written on spiritual formation, and basically said, in the first half of your life, it's all about acquisition. You're acquiring experiences, you're acquiring relationships, you're acquiring successes, accomplishments. If you meet somebody in their 20s who's not ambitious, there's something wrong. They need to climb the ladder. It's part of growing. It's part of seeing what you're capable of. But in the decade of the 40s, things begin to change. I'm looking out the Rocky Mountains right now. There's a continental divide up there where you're going uphill and then you reach the peak and then you start going downhill, and sometime in your 40s, you reach a place where life can no longer be about accumulation, about accomplishment, about conquering new hills. It's about relinquishment. The second half of your life is being able to give away what you've received. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh my goodness, I've got a lot to learn there. And I'm not sure I want this new challenge, but it doesn't go away. I realize that is, there is a major posture shift that you go through sometime in your 40s that it's not just climbing the ladder anymore. It's being able to bless others as a result of the relationships, experiences, accomplishments that you have made. And it's not that you don't keep striving and growing and learning and things like that. But the focus is more what can be used to what can be given away for the benefit of others.
That's good. Yes, I've often said that you spend the first part of your life, your passion is you want to change the world. The last half of your life, you want to make a difference. And so it's like a distinct, and there is, I think it happens in the 40s. I think there is a shift that happens there. So that's interesting that you bring that up. You guys have anything?
That's good.
You're not there yet. You're kind of in the middle. You're almost reaching that.
He's confessing names right now.
You're going to be reaching the peak soon.
That's right.
So it's all going to be downhill.
Fantastic.
Soon for you.
Fantastic. Yeah.
Well, there's probably going to be a flat tire or two on the way
down. Yeah. Oh, for sure. For sure. Oh, man.
Exactly.
No, I have to tell you my flat tire story.
Yes.
When I first came out to Denver, after having lived in Chicago for 34 years, I came to Colorado, and I still had my Illinois license plates here in my first 6 months or so, waiting for them to expire so it would be worth my while to get the Colorado tags. Took a bunch of Doctor of Ministry students up to Dillon, Colorado, which is up in the Summit County. It's way up in the mountains. And we attended church there together and had a picnic. And, so it was a good time. But I go back to the parking lot and I've got a flat tire. What? Mm. And as I'm looking at the car, there's a nail in the side of the tire. Mm-hmm. And I thought, how does a nail get into the sidewall of my tire? That doesn't happen by accident. Mm-hmm. All I could figure is that somebody must have seen Illinois plates. And in Colorado, license plates from California, Texas, and Illinois are not often welcome.
That's good to know.
All these imports, all these people who move in from from out of state,
Colorado. Wow.
Of course, I was not really one of those because I just moved here from Illinois. But they're sort of viewed with suspicion. Why are you guys coming and spoiling our state?
Yeah.
And so I thought, I wonder if this nail is a little welcome to Colorado from a real native.
Yeah.
Especially on the side.
You might have uncovered
it. Yeah, I thought that's really weird. But one of the D-Men students, Ashley Ellis, still remember his name. He's a good old boy from Tennessee. He was a pastor down in the hills of eastern Tennessee. And he said, I think I can fix that. And I said, God bless you, Ashley. Go for it. And sure enough, we had just enough air in the tire to make it to the filling station. He got a patch kit. And it's said very clearly on the patch kit, do not apply to the sidewall of the tire.
But
Ashley said he thought he could fix it, and he did.
Wow.
And I just thought, wow. And, that tire lasted a whole nother year before I, replaced it. And that patch in the sidewall.
That's grace.
That's grace. Exactly. That is grace.
How about that?
Every time I saw that tire, I thought, well, thank you. Thank you, some unknown person in Colorado who tried to welcome me with a nail in the side of the tire. And even more, thank you, Ashley, for redeeming that situation.
Man,
evil.
Yeah.
I'm glad you shared that story because I think I just uncovered the mystery.
Yeah.
Brian is from Chicagoland.
Yeah.
And he has a Cubs sticker on the back of that van.
Oh, right. There's your problem. There you go.
It was 2016, people. All right. It's not going to happen again for another 100 years. No need to get violent.
Yeah. Good night. So maybe it's all about Illinois people. We're not welcome in any other state.
I guess.
That's great.
How about that?
Well, Marshall, thank you for being on the show. Yeah, where can people still find your work or connect with you? And as I know, there are people that are wrestling with this and probably need some insight.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I think I'm still associated with Denver Seminary. So, marshall.shelley@denverseminary.edu is my email. I'd be happy to interact with anybody that way. And, I enjoy, talking about these things or about Colorado natives or the Denver Broncos or Chicago. So
lots of options.
Lots of options.
And the book is called Well-Intentioned Dragons.
Yep.
And you can go online.
And I've got the 85 edition. So I got the one.
This is more information than you want to know. But, when the publisher wanted a second edition, they decided to change the name to Ministering to Problem People in the Church. And I objected. I said, who's going to buy that?
Yeah. I agree.
Well-Intentioned Dragons has some, if you put, electrodes on somebody's head, and say Well-Intentioned Dragons, things flicker.
Yeah.
You put Ministering to Problem People in the Church, that's a flatliner. There's no imagination to that.
Yeah.
But they said, with search engine optimization, we need titles like that have searchable words. And so I said, okay, you guys know. But I'm not sure I agree with that mm-hmm. yet. So well-intentioned dragons is still the memorable phrase.
Yeah, because it steals the imagination of me determining what size wings or color of your eyes or which one are you, you know?
Exactly. That reptilian skin that you see, you know, you just don't see that with that other title.
No. Well, thank you for being with us today.
Well, it's been good to be with you guys. Thanks so much.
Yep. And thank you for joining us on the Reimagined Podcast. As always, you can follow us on Spotify, iTunes, or Overcast, and you can download and rate any of the episodes. You can join us on the reimaginedcast.com website. So for Brad and Brian, I'm Greg. Thanks for listening to the Reimagined Podcast.